on.
I'm busy. Look, there goes the game.
You're listening to Ithaca Now, WICB's weekly news program focused on stories in the Ithaca community. I'm your host, Sarah Payne, and thanks for joining us. On tonight's show, Caroline Grass and Joshua Pantano will bring us the second of their two-part series on the Seneca Meadows landfill and its impact on the environment. WICB production Lou Barron tells us about the college alumni returning for the Finger Lakes Environmental Film Festival. But first, we have Blake Matthews and Liam McDermott with Community Beat and News Director George Christopher with this week's Politics Beat.
The City of Ithaca has agreed to increase the pay of workers at the Ithaca Area Wastewater Treatment Facility by more than triple the original wage. When the city is able to find a chief operating officer for the plant, that person will be able to make a yearly salary of $77,833 per year, or $37.42 an hour in a typical 40-hour week. A senior plant officer will now be able to make a yearly salary of $68,067, or $32.72 an hour if they work a typical 40-hour week. However, the wages for most of the plant's employees are still expected to remain between $25,000 and $40,000 a year.
The Ithaca Police Department is warning the public about scammers that have been utilizing the police department's phone number and demanding money at the threat of arrest and jail time. By utilizing the local police department's number, the scammer allows victims to believe they are speaking with an official police officer. Ithaca PD has made a statement that they will never contact an individual for money under the threat of arrest or jail. Ithaca PD also urges the public to hang up and verify the information utilizing the dispatch number should a person hear threatening statements for money.
Hundreds of grad students at Cornell University here in Ithaca peacefully protested in front of the College of Veterinary Medicine, demanding an increase in their pay. Currently, the university is offering an 8% increase in the pay that grad students receive for their work. The students say, however, that they need more than 8% raise in order to pay for things such as their rent. According to a study done by Alternatives Federate Credit Union here in Ithaca, a resident in Ithaca must make at least $16.61 an hour when working a typical 40-hour week, or an annual income of $34,548 to affordably live here in Ithaca. The university says that they support the students' right to peacefully protest, but there is still no word yet on whether or not the university will offer students higher than the 8% raise.
In establishing recent COVID-19 updates, Tompkins County and New York State cases both seem to be pointing in the same direction. As of a week ago, Tompkins County has 36 cases of COVID-19 per 100,000 people, the second lowest in the central New York area. On the flip side of last Saturday, Seneca County had the highest cases of COVID-19 in the state with 99 cases per 100,000 people. In recent data, the only number that has climbed is deaths. One additional person has died from COVID-19, bringing the total Tompkins County death count from the disease to 102. Masks are no longer required in most places, and Ithaca College recently dropped their COVID-19 vaccine requirement for incoming students. In Tompkins County, 93.5% of the population has had at least one dose of the vaccine, and approximately 82.6% of the population is considered fully vaccinated against COVID with two doses. Governor Kathy Hochul has announced the opening of a new cannabis store in Ithaca. William Jane is owned by William Durham, a New York native who has spent most of his life in Binghamton. Durham was previously criminalized by prior cannabis laws, and Hochul and State Senator Leah Webb have both expressed words of support for the opening. For Liam McDermott, I'm Blake Matthews.
This is your weekly Politics Beat. I'm George Christopher. The Ithaca chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America has released 5 endorsements for the Ithaca Common Council's 2023 elections. All 10 seats on the Common Council are up for election, with each ward electing one member for a 4-year term and another for a 2-year term. The Ithaca DSA endorsed 2 incumbents, Fourth Ward Alder Person Jorge DiFendini, and Phoebe Brown. Brown currently represents the 2nd Ward, but is running in the 1st Ward due to redistricting. In the 1st Ward, 4-year seat, the IDSA endorsed Kayla Matos, who is attempting to primary incumbent Democrat Cynthia Brock. In the 2nd Ward 2-year seat, the IDSA endorsed West Fox. Fox is one of three announced candidates in the 2nd Ward 2-year seat, along with Ariel Jackson and incumbent alderperson Chris Haynes-Sharp. Haynes-Sharp was appointed to the council from the 5th Ward to replace Laura Lewis after Lewis became mayor. However, the new ward maps adopted following redistricting will place Haynes-Sharp into the 2nd Ward. In the 3rd Ward 4-year seat, the IDSA endorsed Nathan Sitavaman. This is an open seat, with one other Democrat, David Shapiro, seeking the Democratic nomination. All five IDSA endorsees have also received support from the Working Families Party. This past Tuesday, village elections were held in the villages of Cayuga Heights, Groton, Dryden, and Trumansburg. The village of Dryden was the only one to see contested elections. Village Mayor Michael Murphy was re-elected on both the Democratic Party and the Protecting Dryden lines, taking over 60% of the vote over Republican Thomas Corey. For the Village Board of Trustees, Democrats retained two seats, with incumbent Jason Dickinson being re-elected along with newcomer Thomas Sinclair. Dickinson and Sinclair defeated Republicans Timothy Arnold and Frederick Stock. In the Village of Cayuga Heights, the New Heights Party retained three seats on the Board of Trustees. The Village of Groton Republicans retained their mayorship and two seats on the Board of Trustees, and in the Village of Trumansburg, Democrats retained one seat on the Board of Trustees. Reporting for Ithaca Now, I'm George Christopher.
You're listening to Ithaca Now. I'm your host, Sarah Payne. For 70 years, the Seneca Meadows landfill has taken in trash from New York and the surrounding states. For years, activists have sought to close the landfill, but shutdown dates have continuously been pushed back. In the second of the two-part series, WICB news correspondents Joshua Pantano and Caroline Grass tell us about the environmental impact of the landfill.
Last week in our story on Seneca Meadows Landfill, we heard from activists and residents around Seneca Falls and looked into the politics and local tension surrounding the landfill. In this episode, we'll be talking about the environmental impacts of Seneca Meadows Landfill, as well as alternative options for managing waste. Seneca Meadows is permitted to accept 6,000 tons of waste and produce 100,000 gallons of leachate daily. The landfill produces around 650 million gallons of leachate each year, and the processing of the harmful substance is one of the most contentious issues. When runoff water, usually rain, mixes with permeable solutes such as landfill waste, it produces leachate. While leachate can usually be processed in filtration plants, many landfills across New York do not have this capability, or if they do, they cannot process the volume of leachate that is produced. Leachate usually contains high quantities of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, more commonly known as PFAS. There are many different types of chemicals that fall under the label of PFAS. According to studies by the Centers for Disease Control, PFAS may cause negative health impacts, including increased cholesterol levels, changes in liver enzymes, increased risk of kidney or testicular cancer, and decreased vaccine response in children. According to Seneca Meadows' 2022 sustainability report, Seneca Meadows processed 37.1% of their leachate on-site. The rest of the leachate was transported off-site. Yvonne Taylor of environmental activist group Seneca Lake Guardian explained how wastewater treatment facilities often accept untreated leachate.
That's the problem, is that there are no regulations about PFAS chemicals and where you can send them and just discharge them. So, you know, wastewater treatment facilities all over New York State are accepting landfill leachate because I think what one of the problems is that these PFAS chemicals are kind of what they call an emerging contaminant. Like, nobody really knew about these forever chemicals and where they were coming from. So there was no real concern and no need to, you know, consider these chemicals. So there is no law in New York State that says you can't just dump it into our waterways and into our drinking water resources right now.
One of the sites that Seneca Meadows sends its leachate to is the Passaic Valley Sewerage Commission, located in Newark, New Jersey. Other sites include the Buffalo Sewer Authority in Buffalo, New York, the Steuben Lakes Regional Waste District in Bath, New York, and the Webster Wastewater Treatment Plant in Webster, New York.
So there are four leading causes of PFAS, and landfills are one of those. And, you know, when we look at Seneca Meadows, which is New York State's largest landfill, they report that they produced 75 million gallons of PFAS-laden leachate in a year. And this leachate, there's only a third of it, as you mentioned, that goes through a reverse osmosis process, which takes some of the contaminants out, not all. And that portion is the stuff that goes through the Seneca Falls wastewater treatment facility. So it's sort of like they're trying to appease the locals by saying, well, your part of the leachate is quote unquote clean, which is not entirely true. But the remaining millions of gallons of this PFAS-laden leachate is trucked untreated all over New York State to Buffalo, Watertown, Chittenango, Steuben County, and some of it even New Jersey.
According to the Seneca Meadows 2022 sustainability report, leachate is contained by a liner system and then collected through a network of perforated drains, which would allow water to be released for further processing while trapping larger waste substances that have not yet dissolved into the water. A 2022 study from the U.S. Geographical Survey collected 254 samples from five aquifer systems across the eastern United States to determine the amount of PFAS found in groundwater that is also used as drinking water. The study found that 14 of the 24 different types of PFAS tested were detected in groundwater. Additionally, 20% of public supply and domestic wells contained at least one PFAS detection. The study also found that near certain locations, such as chemical manufacturing facilities and landfills, the quantity of PFAS found in groundwater was much higher. Therefore, towns and cities near large landfills would be more likely to have PFAS in their groundwater. According to Finger Lakes Times reporting, a study by environmental testing company Test America conducted in 2018 found high levels of PFAS in leachate originating from Seneca Meadows. In March of 2023, the Biden administration created new national standards regarding the amount of PFAS that are allowed in drinking water. The Environmental Protection Agency now additionally requires consistent sampling of PFAS in public drinking water systems across the United States. A 2023 report from the agency stated that since PFAS are commonly found in consumer products, landfills are some of the largest contributors of PFAS to the environment. The report also states that traditional methods for PFAS treatment might be unsuccessful. As part of the report, the EPA outlined plans for researching PFAS and figuring out other treatment options. The EPA stated that current treatment options for PFAS are limited and many conventional treatment methods are ineffective. Along with concerns about how these chemicals can affect drinking water, many activists, such as Taylor, have brought up concerns regarding air quality.
Air contamination is a big one, and you know, everybody on the planet should be really concerned about global climate disruption. I don't call it climate change anymore. It's definitely human-caused climate disruption. And landfills are responsible for 17% of all total methane emissions, which is, you know, a greenhouse gas that's 21 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So not only should we be worried about our water, our drinking water being safe, but also, you know, this is a major contributor to global climate disruption and also obviously increasing the harmful impacts of respiratory illnesses with air particulate matter and unseen gases that can harm our health.
In November of 2021, New York residents voted in favor of an amendment to the state constitution that gives every New York State resident a right to clean air, water, and a healthful environment. Town Board Member Steve Churchill talked about his frustration over the amendment because he feels it doesn't apply to members of the Seneca Falls community who deal with the odor and adverse human and environmental health effects from the landfill.
I mean, it's part of our constitution now, but it doesn't apply to Seneca Falls. You know, we get to breathe this stench all the time and nobody's doing anything about it.
Taylor also talked about how this amendment has started to be used in court as an argument against expanding or opening landfills.
A phenomenal amendment to our Constitution. So it's not even like a Department of Environmental Conservation regulation. That is our constitutional right now. And it was passed overwhelmingly among voters in New York. So we've been watching very carefully to see how is this going to be used to defend these rights? And as a matter of fact, there was a landfill ruling recently where a judge preliminarily said constitutional right. There is no questions, no ifs, ands, or buts. You must adhere to this constitutional right. And he upheld the argument that a landfill in the Rochester area was, you know, infringing on those rights of the community nearby. So we'll see what happens with that as it goes through the appeals process. But this initial ruling was extremely promising for any of us concerned about the environment.
Rich Swinehart, CEO of Waterloo Container, a bottling company across the street from Seneca Meadows landfill, expressed his concerns about odor and truck traffic outside the landfill.
First of all, there's always odor. There isn't a day where there isn't horrific odor from there. Some days, you know, worse than others. There's always dust. There's always seagulls with their bird droppings. There's always truck traffic. And a lot of the truck traffic, because it's coming from out of state or downstate, the trucks are in terrible condition. They're not safe to be on the road. New York State State Police, the New York State Environmental Conservation Police, and New York State Department of Transportation use one of our lots to pull in unsafe trucks and to inspect them and then to red tag them so they can't move. But now you've got a truck sitting on our lot leaking garbage.
A study conducted by Cornell University in 2008 showed that garbage trucks traveling through Ithaca, including trucks from Seneca Meadows, were the source of, quote, major safety issues as well as road damage, noise, and offensive odors. Barb Reese, community member and physics teacher at Minders Academy in the Seneca School District, said she feels the state is moving towards more climate-resilient policies, but that there's always more that could be done.
I think New York's policies are going in the right direction, but I also think that more has to be done, especially it's hard being in a small town like Seneca Falls. We are kind of at the mercy of this landfill that just keeps taking in trash. So I know there's always going to be a need for a landfill. I guess that's their argument. But what needs to happen is right now Seneca Meadows takes food waste in with everything else, with the municipal waste that includes food waste. But so much of that does not need to go in a landfill. I feel like we could save landfill space if there were policies that forbid companies, because they are a private company, and they pretty much do what their company policy is. But if the state were to say, you can't operate like that, you can't take food waste and put it in the landfill, that would eliminate some of the odor we have, and it would save space for the things that actually had to be landfilled. It doesn't change the fact that it's outgrown the size and location of where it is here in Seneca Falls, but it would at least, I think, save future generations from what's going on.
The EPA estimates that 24% of municipal solid waste is food waste, which is more than any other substance ending up in landfills. Reese is on the town's Waste Management Advisory Committee and said they are trying to create an organic recycling program for the town to help lessen the waste the town creates, which is only just a small part of what the landfill takes in.
We're trying to plan for a future where we know where our waste is going and that we can handle taking care of it and minimizing what we need to send to a landfill. So we're trying, I mean, the town, there is a group that's trying to do the right thing, to plan for a time when the landfill is actually closed. I've been part of this group for a long time. And so we're hopeful that we'll be able to maybe someday have a you know, a food waste composting area that is just serving of our town or maybe our county. What we don't want is a large-scale composting facility. We don't want to take in New York City's food waste.
Last month, New York City Mayor Eric Adams and New York City Department of Sanitation Commissioner Jessica Tisch announced a plan to offer free composting services that would not require a sign-up for residents in New York City. By 2024, yard waste, food scraps, and food soiled paper products that are set out in a bin on a recycling day will be collected in the program across all five boroughs. Composting programs in the city have existed in the past, but never covered more than 40% of the city. Swinehart talked about how switching to sustainable products, like paper instead of styrofoam, and using reusable bags has helped reduce waste. He also explained that possibly creating smaller community waste management sites could create an alternative to having large landfills like Seneca Meadows.
Right now, there's a huge push locally for, in upstate New York especially, to take all the organic waste out of the trash stream. So the city of Geneva has a grinder where you can bring, you know, vegetables and eggshells, and then it composts it all. And a lot of municipalities should be doing that on their own. They would be cutting a large percentage of what has to go in any landfill. And if people would just get behind some of those movements, what would the actual landfill capacities would be so diminished that every town could have a small landfill someplace for their own use. Or every four towns get together, or, you know, or in a region. And then they would never get huge, like what we've got across the street.
For now, the town of Seneca will wait for a DEC decision on the application for the landfill's expansion. Churchill encouraged all residents who want to talk about their thoughts on the landfill to come to town board meetings to keep fighting for change.
Very few people come to the town board meetings. I like to get people to come and just get up to the podium at the beginning of the meeting, give their name and address, and just say whether, you know, just say something about the landfill, if you're against it or why you're against it. I mean, people really have, I think, given up hope in a lot of ways. People have grown accustomed to it, right? It's right next door to our Walmart parking lot or business district. And it's frustrating. I mean, I sit on a board where essentially, you know, I got my hands tied now that it's 4-1. I don't know. It wears you down. I mean, I wonder about my future. You know, I mean, I wonder about how long I might even stay here.
Community member and brewery co-owner Anna Luisi talked about her love for the area of Seneca Falls and how important preserving the environment is for the community.
I have always said with Seneca Falls, although it is a small town, it is not isolated. So within an hour, you can be in gorgeous Ithaca, you can be in Rochester, you can be in Syracuse. At 20 minutes on either side is Geneva and Auburn. And then in between all those places are wineries and breweries and beautiful state parks and waterfalls. So in a lot of ways, it's like the best of both worlds, where there's a lot of cultural opportunities and things to do in nature. But you do have that small town feel of knowing people and running into people you know and cultivating really good relationships with your neighbors. There's just so much natural beauty and this beautiful source of fresh water, and I think it's important that we really honor that and try to find sustainable ways to move forward so that we can keep this natural beauty that's so special.
For WICB News, I'm Caroline Grass.
And I'm Joshua Pantano.
The 26th Finger Lakes Environmental Film Festival has been underway at Ithaca College since the beginning of the week. The event has been a hybrid of in-person and remote screenings, with IC partnering with Cinemanapolis. WICB Production Director Lou Barron brings us this report.
Every spring for the past 26 years, Ithaca College has hosted the Finger Lakes Environmental Film Festival, commonly known as FLEF. My name is Lou Barron, and I know firsthand as a past intern of the festival that the 3 weeks of FLEF are packed.
We're the second longest running environmental film festival in the United States. Okay? Second oldest. We are the only environmental film festival in the world that does new media, music, art, scholars, book launches, journalists, political topics.
That's director of FLEF, Patty Zimmerman.
We have a national and international reputation that is absolutely irrefutable, and I'm not saying that with ego. And so, you know, coming to FLEF is joining a community, and it's also joining an entity that is the part of Ithaca College that goes very national and global.
Notable guests of the festival this year come from far and wide, but some have deep roots here in Ithaca and with FLEF itself as Ithaca College alumni.
I'm Rye Farrow. I'm the director of Move When the Spirit Says Move, the legacy of Dorothy Foreman Cotton. I moved to Ithaca in 2007. I had already started doing this kind of work, but I hadn't gone to film school. So I was actually thinking I was on my way out to LA to get a job out there. And I did get a job out there, and I went like to visit to look for apartments, and I just could feel it in like every part of me that I just did not want to do that. So the documentary studies and production major had just come out in 2013, I guess. So I'm a non-traditional student. I was older than everybody else, but I really wanted to get that degree. And so I decided to not take the job in Los Angeles and stay in Ithaca. And I'm still here.
The story of Move When the Spirit Says Move has deep roots in Ithaca as well.
Dorothy was a civil rights activist, a civil rights leader. She was the only woman on Dr. King's executive staff. She advised him. She wrote or rewrote many of his speeches. And she is not a person that most people know, even though she was always with Dr. King wherever he went. The cameras didn't necessarily include her in the frame. So even if they did, no one would have necessarily known who she was because people were not interviewing women, especially in those days. I learned about her because she lived in Ithaca for the last 25 years of her life, and the Dorothy Cotton Institute that she founded here approached the studio that I work for to ask us to help them make a documentary. And that's how I got involved.
For Patty, programming Rye's film for the festival this year and giving it significant screen time was important.
We immediately saw that this is a film that we could probably give a run to, rather than having one or two screenings, that we could give it a run where we could show it every day. And the reason they're getting a run is not because Rye is an alum, okay? It's because of the film is significant. So we needed to make that film accessible to many, many communities. And having just one screening on a Saturday night is not going to serve all those communities. The film's in great demand. It's getting into quite a few film festivals.
While Patty didn't have to look far to find Move When the Spirit Says Move, programming the festival is a time and research intensive process.
So the programming for each festival takes about 18 months. So right now, people are approaching me with projects, all right? So I've already had musicians talk to me about concerts they want to do, dancers. I have film distributors approaching me about films they think they're going to pick up. So I'm inundated with people who want to do things. And, you know, and that to me is very exciting.
Another alum, Matt Podolsky, approached Patty with his new short film.
I just reached out because we have a new film that is out on the festival circuit right now called Hellbent. It's a short documentary. It's about 20 minutes. It's a story about hellbender salamanders, which are the largest salamander species in North America. But it's also about fracking waste and rights of nature and different legal strategies that small communities are using to prevent horrible things from happening to their community, right? Patty responded with like, well, why don't we do a whole block of Wildlands Collective films, which obviously I was stoked about. And so
the Wildlands Collective is Matt's nonprofit production company.
It also serves as an artist collective for folks who work in the wildlife film industry. I started the organization, 12 years ago now. And, you know, I set it up as a nonprofit because I was working on my first feature documentary. I finished that first film, which was about California condor recovery and conservation issues surrounding that endangered species. And then, you know, started thinking about like how I wanted to approach the next project. Really early on, collaboration with other filmmakers in the industry and other sort of like-minded folks who were producing content focused on impact, like producing conservation-oriented films and podcasts, like where the goal was to affect the outcome of the issue that we were telling a story about. And some of the films that we're screening at Finger Lakes Environmental Film Festival this year are a product of, you know, those collaborative relationships with our members.
Patty wants to make one thing very clear about the programming process.
I never would invite anybody just because they're alums. They are invited because the work they do is significant, that their contributions are significant, and that their contributions are rattling the world, that their contributions in some way are recalibrating how we think about things.
The story of how 2022 graduate Kaylin Meadows was invited to the festival proves it. This is Kaylin.
I make video essays under, I guess, pen name Kiki Crazed, and I do it on my YouTube channel with the username Kiki Crazed, and also for different publications and clients by commission. I started it in high school, but it's something I continued through college, and I see at FLEF this year I'll be screening some of my video essays at Cinemopolis and doing a little talk back, just showing some of my existing work and chatting about it. I think I'm definitely going to show my video, The Two Worlds of Wolfwalkers, which originally was just made as like a personal self-initiated project for my YouTube channel. But then the one of the directors of the film, Wolfwalkers, saw it, and it got added to the Blu-ray box set of Cartoon Saloon films. And that video is just breaking down the visual style of Wolfwalkers and how it just visually communicates the divide between nature and civilization that the whole movie's about.
This is a kind of crazy story. She doesn't know this, by the way. Somebody who I write books with, well-known film scholar, he's been to FLEF a couple times, said, well, you should think about doing video essays. And I said, you know, I hadn't really thought about video essays. And so he said, what's really interesting is they don't have distributors. They put it out there for free on the internet. And so it's a whole different distribution system. We're thinking, okay, festivals aren't showing video essays because they live on the internet on YouTube channels. So then, of course, that makes FLEF want to go there. So then we start poking around, and another person I know, I can't say who this is, it's a film scholar, said, there's this really interesting, somewhat youngish video essayist who's coming up, who's gotten a lot of traction in the UK. And the person's called Kiki Crazed. So someone else told me. So I go and look at Kiki Crazed, and I said, oh my God, that was my student. You know, of course, one of my wonderful, star, brilliant students, Kaylin. So one of the great thrills of my life is I emailed Kaylin and I said, you need to call me.
At 2 a.m. And I don't even know what I thought. It was just asking like if I'm in Ithaca and if I still do video essays. And then she called me and invited me.
And, you know, I love being the phone call that says, you're in FLEF.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't expecting it, but I immediately said, like, yes, obviously I want to be a part of FLEF. Like, because I was going to go anyways. So being a guest just makes the experience even better.
As students, all of these alumni were involved with FLEF itself. This is by design.
Students are involved in FLEF in myriad ways. So the first, of course, is we have an internship program. Those interns have ranged from bloggers to, this year, they're brand ambassadors doing social media. Then we have classes on campus that are embedded in the festival. And people will have FLEF be basically on their syllabus as something students do. Then there are students who just want to go. I think it's just a great opportunity. I hope the students think it's a great opportunity.
In talking to them, they clearly do.
I was an intern for FLEF in one of the years that I was at IC, and it feels nice to, like, you know, that experience kind of made me feel like I was sort of on the inside of a festival because I was learning about it as a student. And now it's like, you know, even more on the inside of a festival as a filmmaker.
I worked with FLEF for 2 years when I was at IC. First, I was an intern doing the blog and also interviewing guests. And then second year, I was an assistant to the producers. I wanted to get like film festival experience and be involved in a film festival that had a more like specific focus, just because I think like those are really valuable and the conversations that come out of them are really valuable.
I did a double major in cinema photography and environmental science. And so the fact that I got to attend LEF as a student, like, showed me for the first time that it was possible to combine these two things. When I was trying to figure out like what I was going to do, and when I decided that, oh, I think I want to try majoring in these two different things, you know, a number of advisors like sort of warned me against that, like, oh, you're gonna have to take a bunch of extra credits, it's gonna be challenging. There were definitely moments where I questioned it, but then it's like, there, here's this whole film festival like hosted by the college that combines these two things. So I mean, the festival itself was very important in me sort of developing the seeds of like this career that I've built.
They remember screenings and events from their time as students well.
It was Darwin's Nightmare. So it probably was like either 2005 or 2006 left. And it's just such, I mean, it's a really bleak film. You know, it sort of like shows just this utter devastation that has happened to this ecosystem and like the negative consequences for the human communities in this area, as well as like how the collapse of like an ecology affects the human communities, is sort of what it's about. And it's sort of like, it's so dire, you know, it leaves you feeling like, oh my God, like, is there something I could do? Like, you know, it's a little bit overwhelming, but as a filmmaker, it was like shot in a really interesting way and shot in a very like minimalist style. And you could tell that like they weren't using fancy, big, expensive cameras, you know, and the filmmakers clearly were like, had embedded themselves in this community and had like developed relationships and built trust with these characters, you know. And I think that really resonated with me and certainly like influenced the work that I've done, for sure.
My first year, so 2 years ago, Terry Francis was doing a book launch. But I knew Terry Francis through her video essays, so I went to the event. I think I was working the event, and I asked a question about video essays. I tried to, like, work video essays into, like, every event that I went to. And just in general, like, I like the new media exhibitions just because I think it's neat. And then I also like going to the talkbacks and the events and hearing what artists have to say about their work. It was just nice because it felt like it was my, like, an introduction into like this whole world.
And the feeling of returning for all of them is a thrill.
It's exciting for me. You know, the last time I screened a film at FLEF was 10 years ago. And it was like, I was at the very beginning of like my filmmaking career. Right. And now it's 10 years later and I have like a lot more to kind of show for the work I've done. And it's awesome to like have the opportunity to like help program a whole block of like films that I've helped produce.
I don't know. I mean, it's nice to just be able to go to the events and not have to work them. It's nice to be able to take it in and not have to worry about, you know, any of my like responsibilities working the events. And I'm just excited to go to stuff in person, especially at Cinemopolis. I'm excited to see the movies on the big screen.
Yeah, this screening is the one I've been looking forward to the most. I mean, it was like really exciting to have the world premiere be in Los Angeles, and it felt, you know, fancy and stuff. I got to go to the Directors Guild of America there for a special brunch. That felt really great. That was my favorite part of that trip. But to have this film screening at FLEF in Ithaca is like, it's just really coming full circle for me, because I remember one of the first years that I lived in Ithaca, I went to FLEF just as a participant. Like I wasn't a student at Ithaca College yet or anything. And I just remember, you know, realizing what a great festival it was. And the filmmakers that were there were just from all over the world. And I just remember thinking, wow, I wonder if like someday I might have a film in a festival like this. And now I do. So yeah, it's kind of surreal and really, really exciting.
If you are interested in attending Rye, Matt, and Kaylin's screenings, find all of the dates, times, and ticket information at cinemopolis.org.
That's all for tonight's edition of Ithaca Now. You can listen to all of our stories on wicb.org. And if you'd like to listen to past shows, follow WICB on SoundCloud and subscribe to Ithaca Now to hear the show anywhere, anytime. Also, subscribe to the latest to hear our daily newscast every weekday. Just search WICB News Presents on your favorite podcast app. For more updates throughout the week, follow WICB News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. This show wouldn't happen without the support and assistance from Manager of Television and Radio Operations, Jeremy Menard, WICB Station Manager, Connor Hibbard, and Programming Director, Harrison Kona. Thank you. Ithaca Now is produced by News Director, George Christopher, with assistance from News Production Director, Liam McDermott, and our Weekly Coordinator, Inbayini Onbarasan, and Social Media Coordinator, Chess Cabrera. All of the music from our show's intro and outro come from Dr. Dundriff of Louisville, Kentucky. Have any feedback, story ideas, just want to say hi? Feel free to reach out by emailing news@wicb.org. We will be back with the full episode of Ithaca Now at 7 p.m. next week, Sunday.